old classics while this you know thing is going on, and with no people around. So I started with all of Tolkien's stuff, and I ran into the word fell, and I thought, you know, I have run into this quite a bit, not as the past form of fall, but describing a person that's not very nice. And then I picked up the Yorkshire Vets books again, and they use fell a lot, but it's describing something in Yorkshire geographical. And I can't tell if it's obviously a mountain or a cliff, but it's not like a hollow. I don't know what that is. So this is a really interesting word to me.
So what are these two fells, Martha? F-E-L-L, right?
Yeah, so you're seeing fell in those books, or in the Tolkien books anyway, as sort of a synonym for cruel. I mean, it's weird to see that word used as an adjective, right?
Right. And it's always a bad guy that they use it. He used it as a description.
Caroline, there is a place where Tolkien describes the Nazgul as fell riders. And there's another place where he describes fell beasts. I think he's talking about the things that live in the mines of Moria.
Mm. Oh, okay. The Balrog.
The Balrog, but other things that are under there, the unnameable things that we just don't know about, never find out about, really. But fell beasts and fell riders, these are the spirits of nine kings who are taken over by the Dark Lord.
Right. So you can kind of guess from the context that fell in those situations means cruel or fierce or vicious. And the etymology is a little bit murky, but it may come from an old French word that means the same thing. And the light bulb for me is that some etymologists think that it is connected to the word felon.
F-E-L-O-N, as in a criminal.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And you probably know the expression at one fell swoop, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's the same idea.
So that means an evil swoop or one instance of something evil.
Yes, like a ruthless and deadly attack by a bird of prey.
Got them all in one fell swoop. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, now the other books, the other sense of fell as a feature of the landscape, that's a new one on me. Do you have any thoughts about that, Grant?
Yeah, so Tolkien and James Herriot both talk about the fells, and a fell is an elevated bit of land, and there's a couple contradictory meanings. One is a hill or a mountain. Not necessarily like a tall, tall mountain. We're not talking about the Himalayas, but maybe a rise in the land. And sometimes, though, it's a level field that's in an altitude, usually an uncultivated plain or uncultivated mesa of some kind. The two fells are etymologically unrelated. It's just an accident of history that they're spelled the same.
Oh, okay. All right.
Caroline, we are so grateful for your calling and sharing these thoughts with us. We wish you and the pup the best.
Take care of yourself.
With my pleasure. I really enjoy it. It's my favorite show on NPR.
Oh, that's nice. All right.
Thank you so much.
Be well.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Take care. We'd love to hear about what you've been reading and what's sustaining you these days. Give us a call, 877-929-9673, or tell us about it in email. Our address is words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hey, this is Greg Rivas from San Antonio.
Hey, Greg, welcome to the show.
How can we help you?
I work in the tech industry. I joined a new team about 2 years ago, it's the same team I'm with now, and they had this funny term for describing something that that was sort of tedious and lengthy. So if they needed to go through code and make a simple change, you know, 10,000 times, they would refer to that as shaving yak hair. And it would be like, oh, I gotta shave the yak hair for this thing, and I'm still in the middle of that, and I can't help you. They kind of say these things, and I had never heard that before. It was just an interesting turf phrase.
And you took shaving yak hair to mean, what, fiddling with a lot of small things?
Yes. So basically, they have a large but monotonous workload ahead of them, and it's shaving yak hair.
Did you Google it?
I have not Googled it.
Okay, because you would have probably been a little confused, because if you Google it, you're going to come across a television show called Ren and Stimpy. Do you remember Ren and Stimpy?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely do.
And that's where the term originated. There was a 1991 segment of the Ren and Stimpy cartoon. Remember these two little weird Nutballs. Just the goofiest show you ever wanted to see. I think one of them was a chihuahua. What was the other one? I don't remember.
I think it was a cat.
A cat, yeah. Anyway, in this segment, they have a holiday called Yak Shaving Day, where they hang diapers, they shove coleslaw into rubber boots, and they wait for the shaven yak to float by. And it's ridiculous and hilarious, of course, because the show was somebody's fever dream. I don't know what else to say about Ren and Stimpy. It was the weirdest thing. In any case, I guess it caught someone's fancy. And by 2002, this expression, yak shaving, had really kind of held its place in the tech world to mean a couple different things, not just the way you used it, but to not just mean you doing a lot of small stuff, but also sometimes doing useless stuff instead of what you should be doing, you know, and meaning the small stuff you have to do before you can do the work you want to do or the work that's really important. So it's always about kind of stuff getting away of the real thing, or the big thing. But in any case, it did come from that cartoon, Ren and Stimpy, this weird, weird show about shaving a yak. I don't really know.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, and they it wasn't just that one episode. They also had a video game about yak shaving. It came up more than once, and there's a song, and it's really delirious.
Yeah, I think that definitely fits how it seems to be used colloquially here. Everybody seems to use it for you know, a team of like 40 people, and I had no idea, like, what does this mean?
Well, it's so evocative, you know, you don't even need to know the etymology. I mean, it's really cool to know the etymology, but just picturing shaving a yak.
And that's exactly what the way they use it is like, hey, I really want to work on your cool thing, but, you know, I got to go get through patching all these machines, and it's going to take the rest of today and tomorrow. So I'm, you know, yak shaving.
Yeah, shoving coleslaw into rubber boots.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I like
here
that one,
go.
Too.
Greg,
thanks for sharing that.
Take care of yourself.
From your workplace.
Thanks, guys.
All right, bye-bye.
You know, I went to a musk ox farm outside of Anchorage, Alaska, and I know they're not the same animal, so
right. Nobody
needs to correct me on that, but boy, just imagining shaving one of those with my little Gillette, what a great expression. We'd love to hear about the language and jargon from your workplace, so call us 877-929-9673 or share your stories in email to words@waywardradio.org.
This show is about language seen through family, history, and culture. Stay tuned for more Away with Words. Support for Away with Words comes from Jack and Caroline Raymond, proud sponsors of Wayward Inc., the nonprofit that produces and distributes this program. You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. There was a time when William Shakespeare wasn't William Shakespeare. There was a time when he was just another little 7-year-old going off to school. So what exactly was he taught? And how did his schooling shape the writer and thinker he would become? A wonderful new book called How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education, has some answers. It's by Scott Neustock. He's a professor of English at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. Neustock says Shakespeare never had what we think of as English classes. Those wouldn't come along for a few hundred more years. Instead, Shakespeare's grammar school in Stratford was conducted in Latin. He was schooled in compelling stories from ancient sources. He was taught to take apart, study, and imitate the language of the greats who preceded him. He was educated in the art of disputation, of taking one side of an argument, making the case, and then taking the opposite position and doing the same, sort of like to be or not to be. And it was that regimented curriculum that led to the bard's creative achievements. Neustock shows how many of the educational practices of Shakespeare's time actually nurtured the mental play and creativity and freedom that later flourished in Shakespeare's writing. And he goes on to describe how, even if your classes aren't in Latin, you can still adapt those approaches to stretch and hone your own mind. He insists that education must not be just accumulating data, but learning the craft of thinking, a craft that can be taught like any other. He writes, Learning to think means picking up that feel, akin to a baker's awareness of the consistency of dough, a doctor's gentle pressure on the patient's body, a sailor's hand on the tiller. And Grant, speaking of craft, one aha moment I had while reading this book was about the craft of writing plays. Because before we had the word playwright, someone who wrote plays was known as a playmaker. The word playwright came later. And of course, it's not W-R-I-T-E, it's W-R-I-G-H-T. Because, as you know, wright was an old word for craftsman or maker, like the wheelwright who crafts wheels, or the boatwright who builds boats, or the wainwright who builds wagons. A playwright crafts plays. I thought that was so cool. It was this light bulb moment for me.
It's as much about putting pieces together, putting material together, as it is about ideas. The beginning writer might think it's about inspiration when some of it is about the mechanics of it.
Yes, yes, exactly. And measuring and polishing and mm-hmm. looking at it from all different angles. I just love that insight. And the whole book is like that. It's actually a joyful book. I found it exhilarating and witty and amiable and bracing. It's like no other book I've ever read. You can tell it's the distillation of wide reading by somebody who's a Renaissance man himself.
I also liked your opening thought about Little Billy Shakespeare.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a time before when he was just Little Billy.
Little Billy throwing rocks.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
Playing kick the rock with his kids in the playground.
Yeah. So I highly recommend this book. The book is How to Think Like Shakespeare, Lessons from a Renaissance Education, and it's by Scott Neustock.
Thank you for that recommendation, Martha. I will definitely check that out. And we'd love to hear what you've been reading and what you recommend for us. 877-929-9673. Email words at waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, my name is Quincy Brown in San Diego. How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you doing, Quincy?
Oh, I'm just awesome. So during the whole COVID-19 pandemic, I've been working as a delivery driver. And one day, my wife and I was joking around, given that she's been in the house the entire time with my little daughter, that I'm out having fun, gallivanting, running into the strumpets. Strumpets. Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know what a strumpet is, you know, and we're laughing about it. And she's like, yeah, you're having a good time and getting out of the house and you're going to run into strumpets. So what is a strumpet? I've never heard of this word. I just need some help.
So she's locked down in the house, and she thinks that you're just mm-hmm. having the time of your life running into, what, women of questionable morals? Is that what you thought?
Well, maybe, because as a delivery driver, we have to go to doors, and we have to, you know, climb stairs. And sometimes our customers are really hungry and appreciative. And her friends tell her stories of, you know, interactions. We'll just say interactions of, you know, lonely Postmate guys running into, you know, people who are in the house lonely by themselves. So I didn't believe it. I'm just joking around. But I still never heard of the word strumpet. I've been lost. I've been kind of stuck.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
That's a good sign if you don't know the word.
Yeah, it's a good sign. Yeah, if you don't know the word.
Okay.
I have heard the word before. It used to mostly mean a prostitute or a woman of loose morals. It's about 700 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, probably comes from an old German word meaning a dirty, untidy woman, and with a French feminine et suffix, making it like a extra feminine word. It's similar to words like trollop. But these days, both trollop and strumpet both have really lost a lot of their semantic force, as we would say. So they mean something more like floozy, or just someone who's a big flirt, a tease, or sexually provocative. So not necessarily somebody out there selling themselves on the street.
Right. Okay, I give it to my wife and her large vocabulary.
Yeah.
Awesome. 700 years old.
Good crossword word.
Awesome.
Strumpet.
Well, thank you, guys. I think we can finish the joke now when she wakes up.
So she thinks you're out there, what, delivering pizzas, and it's like the start of a porn movie?
Well, I mean, younger married man in San Diego delivering food, you know, and yeah.
Getting big tips and
but
so forth.
Again, all jokes. Exactly. Because we joked about that when we first started. I'm like, yeah. Oh, babe, I get these nice tips. And she's like, what are you wearing? Is that cologne? And I'm like, yeah. Why are you wearing cologne? I'm like, because I like to present myself a certain way. She's no more cologne.
Yeah. So, and it's going to get hot soon. You're going to be wearing shorts, right?
You're wearing your Friday night clothes? Yeah. That's the question.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the silk shirt and the hair done up? Or is that what's happening?
That's so funny. Well, truth is, I actually do always wear a suit. I'm the one delivery guy who comes up with a full button down and, you know, cars all perfectly shiny. And
that'll
I
give
market
you the tips,
myself
won't
well.
It? Yeah, that'll bring the tips in. People appreciate that care.
Yeah, it sounds like if she's using an antiquated word like that, then she really is kidding, right?
Yeah.
Of course. That's the thing. Me and my wife, we always joke about every taboo subject. As we're, you know, under 30 and been married for 5 years now, and, you know, all of our friends are single and still living that life. So we always joke around about it.
Oh, that's delightful.
Quincy, take care of yourself. Thanks for calling, and give us a ring sometime, all right?
Definitely. I look forward to calling in again.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Call us 877-929-9673. Across a handy word the other day, pickthank. That's spelled P-I-C-K-T-H-A-N-K.
Pickthank. Pickthank.
Mm-hmm.
How old are we talking here? 100, 200, 300 years?
At least back to 1460. It's
okay, is this a
old.
Rude word?
No, it's not rude. It's archaic and literary. You really don't hear it much anymore, but it's a handy one.
Okay, so this is this something you would yell across the parking lot at somebody who dinged your car? No, so not rude. Not that rude either. Okay.
No, not that rude, but you might use it to describe someone you don't really respect. Noah Webster defined a pickthank as a whispering parasite or an officious fellow. And it's a person who curries favor with another person by informing against somebody else. So sort of a flatterer or a sycophant.
Okay. Butt kisser.
Yeah, it's sort of the same idea as curry favor. You know, when you try to pick a thank from somebody, you're trying to extract something by being obsequious.
Oh, yeah. And curry favor, a lot of times the metaphor there escapes people. To curry a horse is to brush it, right? So
exactly.
To curry favor means to groom somebody so that they'll give you praise and pleasantries.
Yes, exactly. So pickthank is not a kind word, but I like it.
It's kind of like picking, instead of picking lice, you're picking thanks.
Right.
877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, I'm Mike from Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania.
Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Okay, I've only heard one person ever use this word before, and that was my mom. Growing up, she would say you're being picayune-ish if you're trying to make an argument. It would like be a reach for like the most minutest example, and sometimes like if you're being spiteful. And then with Hurricane Katrina and in the wake of the hurricane, on the news they had mentioned that there is a newspaper in New Orleans called the Picayune, and I was just wondering what if there's a relationship between the two and like what's the history behind the word, because I I've never heard anyone else use that before.
Yeah, it is the same word. There is a relationship between those usages, but it may surprise you. I mean, you're right that picayune, it means little, insignificant. If somebody's criticizing you, they may do it in a petty way, a picayune way. But what's really interesting about the history of this word is that it goes back to a southern French regional term for a small coin, And the name sounded like Picayune. It was like Picayon or something like that, that was used in Louisiana in the early 1800s. And it referred to a Spanish coin that was worth a little bit more than 6 cents. And so that coin was referred to by speakers of French in that area as Picayon. And so we get Picayune from that. You may be wondering, well, why would you call a newspaper Picayune? That doesn't sound very complimentary. But the fact is that this newspaper is really old. And back in 1837, when it was founded, the Picayune cost, guess how much?
A little less than 6 cents.
Yeah, just one of those little coins.
Is it like a regional? Because like I said, I mean, I grew up in southern Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, my mom was the only one that I've ever known to use that word.
Mm-hmm. No, well, now it's pretty well distributed all over the country, but it had its origins in this country down in Louisiana.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Be well.
You too. Thanks.
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye.
877-929-9673, or send your stories about language to words@waywardradio.org. Hi there, you have a way with words.
Hi, I'm Tricia Dunn from Chesapeake, Virginia.
Hey, Tricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you. I listen to you all the time.
Fantastic. How can we help you today?
Well, I have a very old question. It's almost as old as I am. I will be 73 soon, and back in the very early 50s, 52, maybe 53 at the latest, my dad used to say something that I always wondered if it was something that he made up or if it's indigenous to the Virginia area where I live, because he and my mom both were Virginia natives. He was the consummate Virginia gentleman. I never ever heard him utter anything that wasn't totally proper. But sometimes when he would get annoyed with my mother, he'd say to her, "Oh, Jackie, go sit on a tack." And I was so young, and she never said anything back. They weren't mad at one another or anything. She never said anything back. But after I had heard him say that maybe two or three times over about a year's period of time, I was probably maybe five and a half at the time. I said to my mom, "Mama, what is a tack?" I mean, if he'd said go sit on a nail, I would have known what that meant, but I wasn't familiar with tacks. And she explained it to me. And so then I thought, okay, and I didn't ask her anything else. But I always wondered if there was some basis for that, some old saying that had been around maybe in his family or in this area for a long time.
And she didn't take offense at that, right?
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay. But
well, like I said, they got along fine. I mean, you know, it wasn't a mean thing. It was
right.
Just a, oh, you know, go sit on a tack.
Okay. Yeah. We can talk about it. Did he say anything else along those lines? Did he ever say, go climb a tree?
He would tell my sister to go climb a tree all the time, and she did. And she probably still does to this day, and she's 70 years old.
But did he mean it as a way of saying, stop bugging me, get out of my hair?
More of a sense of I'm frustrated type of a thing, but he wasn't mad.
Right.
You know, I think
gotcha.
There's a difference in being mad and frustrated, but that's what he said.
There's this whole batch of things that you say, and those are some of them, to get people to leave you alone. And go sit on a tack has been one of those since at least the 1880s. Go sit on a tack.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And some go fly a kite and go climb a tree, go jump on a lake, go soak your head, go chase yourself. Go run in traffic. These are all things that say when somebody's annoying you and you just basically saying, leave me alone. Stop bothering me. Was your dad. Your dad's go sit on a tack is one of the politer ones. There are many offensive ones that we can't say on the air, of course. But
he was a very polite person, extremely polite person. And he was born in 1921. So apparently what he was saying is one of those that comes probably back in his family from the 1800s.
It could be.
Late 1800s.
He could have just learned it on the playground because it's certainly something that kids would say. And there was mm-hmm. this heyday for them in the early 1900s when a lot more of them were created. And you can find them in joke books and little tidbits shared in newspapers. There's one joke that etymologist Barry Popick discovered. What time is it when you sit on a tack? Springtime.
That's great. I love it.
And then there was a little tidbit in a newspaper from 1890. Did the boss give you a new position? He offered me one, but I didn't take it. What was it? He told me to go sit on a tack.
Oh, that's, I doubt that my dad's boss ever did that to him, but yeah, that's so interesting because I thought this is going way out on a limb to call and ask them this, but It's interesting to know that it probably really was a thing. And, so you answered that very well, as usual.
Well, it's been a delight to talk to you, Trish. I really appreciate your ringing us up. And you call us again sometime, all right?
Okay. Love your show. I'll keep tuned.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank
now.
You.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
A lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, Grant, I'm reminded of the phrase, go fry ice, which is nonsensical. We've talked about it before on the show, but it's sort of that same idea.
Oh, yeah. And I bet our listeners have a bunch more ways to tell people to bug off, to get out of your hair, to go be a pain in someone else's neck. And if you've got one you want to share with the world, let us know, 877-929-9673, or send your ways to tell people to go sit on a tack to email words@waywardradio.org, or let's start a whole big thread on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Thanks to senior producer Stephanie Levine, editor Tim Felton, and production assistant Rachel Weisler.
You can send questions and comments, find stations, get the podcast and the newsletter, and catch up on hundreds of past episodes at waywardradio.org.
Our toll-free line is always open in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673.
Or email us, words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward, Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Many thanks to Wayward board member and friend Bruce Rogo for his extraordinary effort in making this show possible.
Thanks for listening. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the primary sense of sub-Saharan Africa in corporate news media is absence. When Africa is discussed, it's often been, to put it simply, as a material resource and as a staging ground for great nation politics and proxy war. Not as far removed as it ought to be from the Berlin Conference in the late 19th century, when the European powers sat down to decide who got which slice of what the genocidal King Leopold II of Belgium called this magnificent African cake. Challenging and changing that frame requires seeing through the racist fables, the omissions, and hypocrisy that have plagued U.S. news media's Africa reporting through history and up to today. A new book takes that on, and we'll hear from its author. Milton Alamadi teaches African history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he publishes the Black Star News, a weekly newspaper in New York City. He's the author of the new book, Manufacturing Hate: How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media. That's coming up today on Counterspin. Benighted, backward, tribal, corrupt, inherently violent, yet somehow also docile unto imbecility. Listeners will be familiar with the imagery that corporate media have long used to talk about Africa and Africans. Not just tabloids that blare their racism in crude cartoons, elite media have been key in promoting the narrative in which Europeans represent civilization, which they feel moved to provide, on their own terms, naturally, to Africans that could never otherwise attain it. In 1877, a New York Times editorial explained that inferior intellectual development gave Africans, quote, an old touch, a tertiary or pre-tertiary touch about them, affiliating them with the ancient hippopotamus and the crocodile. Close quote. It continued, quote, surely this is a case where the introduction of European civilization would be most justifiable and might well repay the cost. Close quote. That's a long time ago, you say. Okay, but the Times piece, Colonialism's Back and Not a Moment Too Soon, that argued that, quote, the civilized world has a mission to go out to these desperate places and govern, close quote, ran in 1993. A new book makes the point and illustrates it expansively that dehumanizing coverage of African nations and African people has never been accidental or incidental, but part of efforts to justify violent colonization and resource theft and to rationalize continued economic exploitation of Black people and the institutionalized racism intertwined with it. The book is called Manufacturing Hate: How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, out now from Kendall Hunt. We're joined now by the author, Milton Alamadi. He teaches African history at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and publishes the Black Star News, a weekly newspaper here in New York City. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Milton Alamadi.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for that excellent summary, actually, of the book.
Well, I appreciated it very, very much. The book has historical sweep, and that's appropriate because the usefulness of portraying African people as savages, as something less than human, really goes back to early contact, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I decided to focus on the pre-colonial era, when the so-called explorers started to go to African countries from Europe, names like Samuel Baker from England. And we're talking about the early parts of the 19th century. These were actually agents of colonialism, which, of course, was to come much later, the last two decades of the 19th century. They were out there to map the territorial zones in Africa, find the resource locations, and yet they claimed they were there to discover the source of the Nile or some other lake. And of course, as you know, they also arrogantly renamed those large bodies of water. So for example, Lutanzige in East Central Africa became Lake Victoria. And they were very malicious. I'm sure, as you recall in some segments of the book, when you read the writings of Baker, when he was describing Africans, and he was saying they were not to be compared with the noble character of the dog, and such other ugly language. But at the same time, if you read him carefully, that had a specific purpose, because then he goes on to outline the need for Europeans to come and take control of the African continent and to force them to start trading with Europe. So that was actually the primary purpose. The primary purpose was colonial economic control over Africa. The demonization was just the language meant to pacify readers and the citizenship back in Europe, to condition their minds to accept the brutality that would be necessary in order to take control of the African continent. And that was the entire agenda. So I focused on that, and then I showed how the template created by these so-called explorers were later on adopted by professional writers, including by United States media outlets such as National Geographic Magazine and the New York Times, when they started sending writers, actually, to go to the African continent.
Well, along with the adjectives tribal and savage that soften the ground for public acceptance of violent interventions,
in Africa because, you know, after all, these sort of people kill each other all the time.
Exactly.
Misreporting of African countries has left holes in basic historical understanding. If you think about an event or a thing that happened that if Africa were appropriately covered, everyone would know. It would be integrated into our public database. Is there a particular event that comes to mind?
Okay, very good. So let's go back to the Battle of Adwa, for example.
Yes.
When Ethiopia was actually the only African country not to be colonized by European power. And why was that? Because Ethiopians took up arms and they defeated an imperial state. And it was shocking to the entire European establishment. And that was the Battle of Adwa, March 1, 1896, when Italy also wanted to get a chunk of territory in Africa. And King Umberto sent an invading army led by General Barateri and four other generals. So you had five generals, and you had many senior officers. You had thousands of Italian troops with African soldiers from the Italian colony of Eritrea, also fighting on behalf of Italy. So you had 17,000 soldiers invaded. That time, Ethiopia was referred to as Abyssinia, and expected to quickly conquer the country. In fact, the invading commander-in-chief, General Barattieri, had promised King Umberto that it would return back to Rome with Emperor Menelik II in a cage so he could be displayed in the zoo. Huh. But that battle lasted all of 6 hours. The Italian army was completely annihilated. Two generals were killed. One general was captured. Barattieri, the commander-in-chief himself, who promised to come back with Menelik in a cage, fled the battle scene for his dear life. And he was later tried for cowardice, although he was acquitted. 3,000 Italian soldiers were captured, and they were marched back to the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, and they were put to work. So now you have the tables turned. You have Africans now actually subjugating Europeans to work almost like enslaved laborers, and they were there until the following year in October when Italy was forced to pay millions of pounds in reparations before the Italian prisoners were released. But the interesting part about that battle was how the New York Times covered it. Initially, when Italy invaded and was seizing a lot of territory in Eritrea, the coverage was exuberant, really glorifying colonial conquest, and actually saying, we would not be glorifying it if this was a normal situation. I'm paraphrasing now.
Right.
But this is actually great because it's a victory of civilization over backwardness, over barbarians, and over people that had no religious beliefs. When in fact, Ethiopia had been a Christian country since the 3rd century. And also, it then says that now Ethiopia can be brought into the international system of commerce, and the riches of Ethiopia is now going to benefit the entire civilized world. That was if Italy was still winning. And then when the tables were turned and Ethiopia defeated Italy, the headline was now Italy's terrible defeat. Yeah. It was not Ethiopia's great victory. So that was then, 1896. But now let's come to the contemporary era when we see the coverage of the conflict in the Congo, Eastern Congo in particular, mineral-rich Eastern Congo. It's always portrayed, even in the New York Times, as quote-unquote tribal wars, when in fact it is a war by design by corporate interests. Western companies, United States, Canadian, British, and other European companies are benefiting from that war. Now, they don't fight it directly with European or American soldiers, but they use their puppet regimes in Uganda and Rwanda, who are armed by the U.S. and other Western countries, and the invasion of Ugandan and Rwandan soldiers are tolerated by the West. And why is this? Because at the same time that all these Congolese are being killed, these Western mining corporations are actually mining minerals from Eastern Congo. So the general reader would not know any of this because in their mind, this is just another one of those typical, quote-unquote, African tribal wars.
Yeah. Well, you do focus in the book on the New York Times to some extent, which makes sense. It's an influential voice.
Yeah.
And also the importance of an editor. Emanuel Friedman was the New York Times foreign news editor during a very important period. And you say he never took Africa seriously. And the reporting reflected that.
Yes, he never took Africa seriously. And unfortunately, he was there for a very long time as the foreign news editor at very critical times in the history of the evolution in Africa. He was there when the apartheid system in South Africa was being consolidated, this very barbaric system of racist segregation in all spheres and all aspects of life, whether economic, whether educational, whether social. And this is a critical time. If the New York Times, for example, had chosen to take a much more objective approach rather than embracing and actually providing, I would also say, almost like PR for the apartheid system, things might have turned out a bit different in South Africa. But always, you can also interpret it this way, because at that time, of course, the U.S. also had its own domestic issues, particularly in the South, for example. So the New York Times basically took an approach and accepted the argument by the European minority that was governing South Africa that Africans are not really used to our system of civilization, and that's why we need an apartheid system, separateness. And, of course, they never explained why the Europeans had to take the lion's share of the resources and why it could not be the other way around. And we find Emmanuel Friedman, rather than looking at the seriousness of the apartheid system, was focusing on trivial stories that would caricature Africans and show them as essentially people that are uncivilized. So, for example, he would send memos to New York Times correspondents in Africa and ask them things like, oh, we hear that in Africa where the concept of the wheel was not known until recently, bicycles are now proliferating. Could you do us a piece on that? And they were saying, do they have bicycle garages? Do they ride naked on the bicycles? What impact is it having? And then the second major story that was going on in Africa, of course, was decolonization. So in the late 1950s, the New York Times sent Homer Bigart, who by that time was well known in American journalism. He'd won the Pulitzer Prize twice before he joined the Times, actually, when he was with the Herald Tribune. So he was sent to cover how independence was faring in Ghana, which, of course, was the first African country south of the Sahara to win its independence from Britain in 1957. And then from there, he was to go to other African countries that were about to win their independence and then file his reports. So when he gets to Accra in Ghana, he writes this letter, and now I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, to Emmanuel Friedman. And he's confessing that I really cannot get enthusiastic about the so-called emerging republics. The leaders are either crooks or mystics. And he says that Nkrumah, who of course was this great Pan-African hero and first prime minister of Ghana, it's like Henry Wallace in Burnt Cork. He says, I pretty much prefer the primitive bush people, because cannibalism, after all, is the best antidote for the population explosion that everybody's complaining about. How did I find this? I found this actually when I did the research and I went to the archives of the New York Times many years ago when I was still a graduate student at Columbia. And when I came upon this memo, I knew the extent of the racism, but even this was still a bit shocking. But then I said to myself, maybe this was one individual deranged reporter.
Right.
But then I went and I saw the articles published under his byline around that time. And all the language in the articles reflected the language in his personal correspondence with Friedman as well. terms like savages, cannibals, macabre. Those are the kind of words he used in his news stories. But then there was also a lot of distortion and even fabrication. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when he left Ghana, he went to the Belgian Congo. It was called the Belgian Congo at that time, about to get its independence. And he wrote another memo to Emmanuel Friedman, and he said he had been hoping to find pygmies. And by the way, pygmies, one of the most maligned people in all of Western writing about Africa, the pygmies. So he said he wanted to find pygmies to interview them as to what independence meant to them. But he could not find them. They were all in the woods, for example, he said. But then when his article appears in the New York Times, now he's saying to pygmies, independence means they can now have more meat, they can now have more beer, they can now have more salt. And of course, it's so sad because the Belgian Congo experienced perhaps the most horrific history of European colonialism in Africa under demonic King Leopold II.
Yes.
He is estimated to have exterminated as many during his regime, up to 10 million Congolese. And this was a moment where the Times could have taken a serious look and perhaps interviewed some of maybe elderly survivors of that genocidal era, or at least the descendants of those who suffered under Leopold. But instead, this was the kind of story demonizing the pygmies that Bigart and Friedman were focusing on. So it was beyond just inheriting the template from the so-called explorers. It was adopting it and even exceeding it in maliciously distorting the image of Africa. And when the reporting did not really conform with this image, they sometimes took matters into their own hands. So I found a letter written by a Times correspondent in the 1960s, I believe it was 66. And this was Lloyd Garrison, a descendant of the famous abolitionist, William Garrison. And he was complaining about the edited and final version of his article that he read. He found that the editors had inserted a scene describing Nigerians dressed in grass leaves. This is something that Garrison did not himself write. Mm-hmm. And he was shocked when he saw it in the final version of his article. And to his credit, he was one of those who took this seriously and complained about it and said he had found this type of reference to tribesmen in his other articles in the press, and he strongly objected to that.
Well, finally, Milton, you have been working on these ideas for some time now, and for some time people have been saying, this is all very interesting, but I wanted to ask you to talk a little about your efforts to get this information about media into media.
Yes, that is a story in itself. And it's been a great learning experience, actually, to me. And it really lets you look back at the whole concept of objectivity in journalism, which is something they hammer in all the journalism schools, at least when I went to Columbia Journalism mm-hmm. in 92. Because this research that has now ended up in this book started off as a master's paper at Columbia for the master's degree in journalism. And I said, this is really a golden opportunity because the demonization of Africa was something that had bothered me for a very long time, even when I was a teenager, 13-year-old, 12-year-old, actually. So now I have a chance to actually write something serious that can contribute to the literature which is missing. So when I did the research, the paper was actually recognized, at least by my peers and by the faculty. It was awarded the James Wechsler Award. And then Columbia Journalism Review invited me to submit it for publication. And of course, I thought that was very good. This might actually help me start putting it into a potential book form eventually. I keep waiting for it to be published, like one issue came out, the second issue came out, and now I'm about to graduate. And obviously, I would have preferred for it to be published before I graduate. So then I contact the review, and I spoke to the editor at the time, Michael Hoy, and I asked when my paper was going to be published, my article. And then he tells me, oh, there's been a decision made not to publish it. And I was very shocked. I said, well, when were you going to tell me this? And there's no response. And then I say, well, what was the problem? You invited me. You seemed very enthusiastic. You know, what happened? He says, ultimately, two editors supported publication, two opposed, and the executive editor at that time, Suzanne Levine, opposed publishing. And I said, what was the problem or the objection? He says, there was some thought that these things happened a long time ago. And then I said to myself, how are you going to write a history and a critique without going back into the history? So I was very perplexed. And then even more confusing was when I asked to have my paper back. He actually asked me, said, why do you want it back? Which anyone, of course, would find very shocking if an editor asked you why you want your paper back, especially after they say they're not going to publish it.
Exactly.
Actually, he added on to that. He said, why do you want it back? After all, it's not the same as what you gave us. And then that really lit up something in my mind. I said, in that case, that's precisely why I want it back. And I went quickly to the reviews office, which was, in the same building as Columbia Journalism School. I don't know if it still is. And something else shocking happened when I walked in. He didn't expect me to come in that quickly, so he was standing behind a pile of papers. And he was sort of shoving something beneath the pile. And then he sees me, he's shocked. And I wasn't in the mood for nice teas. I said, I just want my paper back. And then he starts going to different locations and drawers searching for this paper. And then he comes back to the same spot where I'd found him standing. And he pulls the paper out from beneath the file. And now I'm really shaking my head. I'm saying, this is something very strange here.
Yeah.
You know, I take my paper and I leave. And before I even got in the elevator, I started reading the paper. And sure enough, the review editors had actually inserted an apology on my behalf at the very beginning of the paper. I can read it verbatim very quickly.
Please.
Recently, the Times granted me access to its archives, including correspondences from the 1950s, when the paper sent Bigart to Africa on a temporary assignment. After studying the archival material, I interviewed several present and former Times reporters. The following excerpts from the material and from lengthy interviews are not intended as an indictment of the Times, whose African coverage has occasionally been distinguished, but as a means of highlighting a problem that all news organizations need to address.
Wow.
So even after this insertion, they still decided not to publish it. So I could only read that one way, that this is coming out of a fear of how the New York Times might react to this. So I did them a favor and I sent it to the publisher of the Times at that time. I believe it was Arthur Ox Sulzberger. And to his credit, Joseph Leadville actually did write to me. And he said, yes, he acknowledged the crude language in their past coverage that my research had discovered. And then he also added that he did say things have changed since then because he himself was a part of pushing for that change. In his case, I do agree. But there's still a lot that needs to be done.
Is there anything else you would like to add for listeners who might be intrigued by this set of ideas?
I hope that people do get a chance to read this book because I think until we understand how Africa, Africans, and descendants of Africans, including in this country, were really made into the other, we will not understand what needs to be done going forward, including for domestic issues of racism right here in the United States.
We've been speaking with Milton Alamadi. Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, is out now from Kendall Hunt. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Milton Alamadi.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Hi, I'm Brad Keselowski, driver of the number 2 Discount Tire Ford Mustang. If there's one thing I've learned after years on the track, it's that having the right amount of pressure in your tires can make or break performance. Properly inflated tires are essential to the health of your car and to keep you driving safely. Check your tire pressure once a month, especially before road trips, or stop by your neighborhood tire retailer for help.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
RCT, Pittsburgh.
We all make choices about alcohol. Kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad. Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em, remind me about that party again.
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations, and they want honest answers in everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's just keep the music going. How about some Hoodoo Gurus, I Want You Back? It's the Viva La Mock radio program here on 88.3 WRCT.
I can still recall the time she said she was always mine, and she lived.
So what's worse? She thinks it's true. Cause that's just her. She always was a little bit confusing. She's not worth the time I had to lose. That's her. I'll never believe her again. She might have to see my.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Welcome, everybody. Hope everybody had a good weekend. Much to discuss, so let's get right into it. We have now a more public battle, essentially, between the most centrist, or some would call it right wing of the Democratic Party, meaning Joe Manchin from West Virginia, and Bernie Sanders, more the left wing of the Democratic Party. And Bernie has basically had it up to here with Joe Manchin and wrote an op-ed, not just anywhere mentioning Joe Manchin, but actually wrote it in a local paper to Joe Manchin in West Virginia, which we're going to look at. Written in the Charleston Gazette Mail, Bernie wrote an op-ed saying, "Let's stand together to protect working families." We're going to look at the op-ed and we're going to look at Joe Manchin's response. Manchin very, very triggered that Bernie is doing this. So let's get right into it. Bernie writing, "In America today, the very rich are becoming richer while millions of working families are struggling to put food on the table or pay their bills. We now have the absurd situation in which two multibillionaires own more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans." Going on to say, "The $3.5 trillion Build Back Better bill, supported by President Biden and almost all Dems in Congress, is an unprecedented effort to finally address the long-neglected crises facing working families and demand that the wealthiest people and largest corporations in the country start paying their fair share of taxes. In fact, this legislation would be paid for by ending loopholes and raising taxes on the 1% and large profitable corporations. The bill would take on the greed of the pharmaceutical industry. Last year alone, while one out of four Americans could not afford to fill prescriptions, six pharmaceutical companies made nearly $50 billion in profits, and the 10 highest paid executives made over $500 million in compensation. Bernie extols the virtues of what's proposed. The bill would expand Medicare. The United States and states like West Virginia and Vermont in particular are seeing populations age, meaning more older Americans and people with disabilities needing home health care. The Build Back Better plan is not only vitally important for seniors, but is enormously important for working families and children. As a result of the $300 direct payments to working class parents, which started with the American Rescue Plan, we've cut childhood poverty in our country by half. It would be unconscionable to see those payments end, which is what will happen if we don't pass the bill." And Bernie going on, explaining all of the great things that the bill actually does. It makes investment in housing. We would reduce homelessness. And then it would, to some degree, deal with climate change. It would create jobs. And Bernie says this is being opposed by every Republican in Congress, as well as drug companies, insurance companies, the fossil fuel industry, and the billionaires. They want to keep the status quo. And Bernie says it's now time to do this. And then he says there's overwhelming support for the legislation, which there is. "And yet," writes Bernie, "the political problem we face is that in a 50-50 Senate, we need every Democratic senator to vote yes. We now only have 48. Two Democratic senators remain in opposition, including Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia." This is directly and accurately calling out Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, although this was in a West Virginia paper, this is focused on Manchin, for his unwillingness to just do the right thing for his own constituents, which I will remind you about with some statistics in a moment. Joe Manchin is not pleased that Bernie did this. Joe Manchin has responded in typical Joe Manchinese, saying, This isn't the first time an out-of-stater has tried to tell West Virginians what's best for them, despite having no relationship to our